Wednesday, March 17th, is one of those marvelous days that I owe to the White House and that I will always cherish. I woke early in the bedroom of the governor's mansion in Nashville. Had just coffee and juice. I wanted to do justice to the breakfast at the Hermitage. And then, after much pondering, put on my green silk ensemble dress and coat and the Roman striped hat, and left at 8 with the governor and Catherine for the airport to meet Lyndon. He was just a little late, only a few minutes. It was later I learned the dramatic reason. He'd gotten a call the night before at 10, informing him that the grave of President Kennedy was being moved during the night, and that there would be a 7 o'clock ceremony at the grave site. Would he like to attend? He decided that he should. So he stood in the rain, sharing an umbrella with Bobby Kennedy, with only Mrs. Kennedy and members of the family present on the gray, misty slope of Arlington, while Cardinal Cushing prayed. And then he dashed as fast as he could to the airport and turned out to be only a half an hour late. But this I didn't know at the time. And I was fearful that the good ladies at the Hermitage and their grits souffle would be inconvenienced by his not being on the dot. How often one cannot understand, simply because one doesn't know the facts. Buford had repeated to me over and over that they weren't making any attempt to get a crowd at the airport. And when Lyndon touched down about 8:40, wearing his white raincoat and a big smile, only a few hundred people lined the fence. These he waved to and shook a few hands, and then we were off to the Hermitage. There were several thousand people along the roadway, and so many American flags all day long through Tennessee. I saw flags, never without a lift of the heart. Many times I'd been to the Hermitage through the years, on our trips through and from Texas, St. Effie and Uncle George, and much later, Linda and Lucy. I looked forward to it eagerly, but this visit was to be different from all others. For the first time in many years, I believe it's only done for presidents, we alighted. There was an old-fashioned, horse-drawn, black carriage. It must have been very elegant in its day, with a dignified old Negro in livery and silk top hat, sitting up front with the reins. And at the horses' heads, an equerry in a gorgeous scarlet suit. Such pageantry. I would have been crushed not to ride in that carriage. Lyndon chose to walk up the block-long avenue, cedar-lined, that led to the white-pillared front porch of the Hermitage. Catherine Ellington and I, Mrs. Fulton, the wife of the congressman, mounted the high step, and I sat at the window, relishing every moment. I wanted to take in everything at once, the inside of the coach, its ancient but elegant appointments, its upholstery, the lifts to the windows, handsome lights. The gravel driveway was lined with people, many children, many with flags, and though it was cold and threatening rain, it was a marvelously festive atmosphere. At the front porch, I alighted with due respect for the photographers, pausing a moment on the steps. This was one picture I wanted. And then there were our hosts to greet us. Pretty white-haired Mrs. Horatia Bunton, spelled T-I-N, the regent of the Ladies' Hermitage Association, and a distant kinswoman of Lyndon. We chatted about it a moment, and others who sat on the dais with us. Actually, it was the front porch. The governor and Congressman Fulton and Catherine, Assistant Postmaster General Macmillan, who had brought the first issues of the stamp, honoring the 200th birthday of the 7th president, and bearing the picture that we have in Lyndon's office by Sully. Of course, Secretary Gardner, my traveling companion, and Pauline Gore, the senator's wife. I made my little speech, and actually this was one I was glad to make. One senses a great presence in this stately mansion. It bears the mark of a unique man and his times. Later on, together we honor an authentic American, a rare man of heroic stature. Of all the presidents of the United States, there are only a few, I believe, whose image remains strongly with us today. Men whom we can visualize as having once been flesh and blood, and not vague shadows on the pages of history. For me, Andrew Jackson was one of those men, a rugged man from the West. It was a proud day for the people. General Jackson is their own president. The people were touched by him. He was one of them. Some of the lines I liked. And if anybody thought there was any allusion to a similarity between President Jackson and the present president, in my mind, they were entirely right. But most of the speech was about education, beginning with the fact that the battle was fought and won for the principle of free, compulsory public schools during Andrew Jackson's time and going on to now, the 18 new laws under which we are attacking old problems with new methods, and a summary of my trip. Mrs. Button presided, and Congressman Fulton spoke, and of course, Buford Ellington introduced us both. And then the assistant postmaster gave us the new stamps,
an album
each to all of us on the platform. And Lyndon was not even on the program. It had been printed before his arrival was known. Buford rose to introduce him. I felt I could see the pleasure it gave him, and certainly me, to have that good friend introducing Lyndon. And that, of course, was the high point of the morning. All of the several thousand gathered out under the cedar trees in front of us. Why are they always cedar trees? At the homes of the old great ones of the South, there must be a reason. The chief of police said the crowd was 20,000. It seemed much smaller to me, but just as many as the grounds would hold, and all eager-faced and warm, many with homemade little signs and flags everywhere. After Lyndon's speech, we walked down into the garden, which I remember so well, affectionately, into the gravesite of the general and his Rachel, and we placed a large wreath, standing for a solemn moment. This was my nearly favorite president, excepting only Thomas Jefferson, probably FDR, and I love his house and his grounds. They are the home of a gentleman. Then Mrs. Button took us through the house, much as I affectionately remembered it, but now I look at it with different eyes, the eyes of a wife of a president, who thinks that someday our house may have a smaller, not so grand, but similar use as this, and meaning, sometime down the years. I loved what I saw, the rooms, the furnishing, the care. I did not like the barriers at the door. They were too jail-like. One must protect, but at the same time invite a hospitable interest in the interior of the rooms. All in all, what the ladies has done is a great credit. Since 1889, they've acquired, paid for, and run this heritage of the nation. Everything had been thought of at the breakfast. We were seated at the long table in the great dining room, I would think about 20 of us, and began with sugared strawberries, and then had grits souffle. There's nothing better. And Tennessee ham. I couldn't have bared to leave Tennessee without ham. Fried apples, beaten biscuit, turkey hash. It was a feast. I was served on Jackson family china. The flowers, they told me, were Rachel's favorites, and there drifted in to us from the sitting room the music of the harpsichord. Charming, sad, the perfect touch, the perfect setting. I sat next to Mr. Button, and we traced the family kinship from the branch that went down to Texas. I talked about the work of the ladies in running the hermitage. He's very proud of his wife, and should be. At the end of one of the most memorable meals I'll ever have, Mrs. Button gave me a small boxwood from the garden at the hermitage. I shall cherish it, either at the ranch or Lyndon's birthplace. Lyndon had been the fourth president. The breakfast at the hermitage, President William Howard Taft, Theodore Roosevelt, and Franklin D. Roosevelt had preceded us, and they showed us a delightful old picture of Teddy on the balcony, and all the crowds around him. We motorcaded into downtown Nashville, through streets lined with people, four or five deep, lots of bands, lots of flags, and drove up to the Capitol, which is on a high hill overlooking the city. There we went to Buford's office and had a little time for rest. I had frozen at the Hermitage, so I'd asked Liz to arrange to get my red dress and coat somehow spirited to the governor's office. Arrived, I gratefully changed sometime during the interim. Buford told us that the Tennessee legislature was the only state legislature to pass a resolution supporting Lyndon's stand in Vietnam. A little before 12, we filed into the chamber for Lyndon's address, the joint meeting of the House and Senate. It was an impressive setting, a sober and expectant audience. Most of the burden of the speech was Vietnam, as it has been over and over and over. A clear expression of the history, and then the news that Bunker would replace Lodge, with Gene Locke to back him up, and Bob Comer to work on pacification. And at the last, a salute to General Westmoreland, who had been stationed close to Nashville, and is remembered with warmest admiration. You could see the tide of approval wash across the room. Then we walked down the aisle with the governor, between the rows of legislators, and back to Buford's office, where there was a delicious buffet spread out, including some more Tennessee ham, typical of these days, is that food necessarily takes second place. You may have two good meals 2 hours apart, or there may be a lapse of 10 hours with nothing. We were going to drive to Columbia, Buford, Linden, and I. As we walked out of the Capitol, there was a band playing and an enthusiastic crowd. Though I'd heard there would be some pickets, I saw no sign of any. Got in the back seat of the car, and then started around the table-like pedestal on which the Capitol sits. Just as we rounded the corner, something happened. It was all so fast, I could hardly believe it. A youth broke from the thinning crowd and flung himself right in front of the car. The driver slammed on the brakes. Immediately, there were officers at his side, but suddenly, a young girl threw herself more successfully flat to the ground, practically under the wheels. They were picked up bodily and moved. And as we went on slowly, it took only a split second, and it would have been quite possible to have missed it entirely. I looked back and saw the young girl's naked legs, her dress around her hips, her feet grasped by one officer, her shoulders by another, being removed from the road. I wonder what would happen, legally, psychologically, in every way, if our driver hadn't been so quick and the officers so alert, and they had been actually hit. Well, in this case, if publicity was what they want, they got sparse mention, a brief paragraph in the paper, and I don't think it even called their names. It was an hour's drive to Columbia, Tennessee, to the Columbia State Community College, a wonderful chance for Linden and Buford to visit. The college is rising from a bare field. You could see a foundation here and there as we went under the cold and dripping skies to the bunting-draped platform led by the youngish president-to-be. I seldom make a speech in Linden's presence. Today, I found myself doing it over and over. In capsule, it was that new colleges like this one are being established at the rate of one a week across our country, mounting from 8 junior colleges at the turn of the century to 680 now. The main theme, the territorial expansion of our country, which had been very much pushed by the president who came from this very area, James K. Polk, under whose administration Texas and the Oregon Country and California were all added to the Union amidst controversy in the storm of war. Now the territorial growth of America has ended, but there's a new age of national expansion, and that lies in education. And then a brief capsule of our trip, from Head Start to Teachers Corps, the Columbia Community College, the product of cooperation between the people of a county and their state and their federal government. It was a tolerably good speech, pleasantly received. And then Linden rose and made a speech I loved. Into a good text, he interpolated with deep passion, lines straight from the heart, that his own college education had meant everything to me at a time when my future hung in the balance. And then, I hope somehow, some way, someday, in the time allotted to me, I may repay the debt I owe, and I shall try. A good many times I have heard him repeat the phrase, while I am president, or in the time allotted to me, and there's always deep down a tolling of the bell in my thoughts. I unveiled a bronze plaque, left a stack of books for the library, heard the words of praise from the head of the school, and then we went down the platform, shivering and heading for the car through the crowd. And it was a friendly crowd of several thousand, braving the dripping skies. Then Liz, who touches every possible base, was there in front of me, the serious-faced little boy scout, a colored youngster, 3 or 4 young folks from Ellensville School, that I had hoped to stop, to watch their use of TV in education. It had to be cut out of the schedule. But she didn't want them disappointed, so she asked them to come there to represent their school. We had our picture made. I gave them a stack of books, big smile and warm words, and then we were in the car and off, Buford and Linden and I, and drove to the home of President James K. Polk, which was really an indulgence for me. Sometime I hope to go to the home of every one of the 36 presidents. By now I must have gone to at least 12. It was a large crowd in the yard of the handsome white brick structure with the elegant front door. This also the home of a gentleman. No pioneer log cabin here. And it, too, had been kept and maintained by a ladies' association. We smiled and waved our way through the crowd, and then inside the ladies who were regents, or who ran the place, lined up to greet us, headed, I believe, by Mrs. Alston Rhett. We had a quick tour. The house was most impressive. Handsome furniture, much of it original. Some had been in the White House with Polk. They did so many of the right things. That is, both of them had their portraits painted by G.P.A. Healy. excellent ones. And Mrs. Polk's dress was designed by Worth. It interests me keenly to see a home of a president and then assess him against the 100 years-plus perspective of history. On the way out of town, we stopped at a Dairy Queen. Lennon had us all scanning the street coming in. He gets famished for something sweet, something to give him energy. Lem brought a handful of cones over, and Lennon devoured one while waving left and right with the other hand. And then we drove back to Nashville, making one stop at a crossroads to see the beautiful Tennessee walking horses that belonged to Buford, one of which he had given us years before, and which now has a lovely colt. It's a bonus for the photographers. We're back at the mansion by 4 o'clock with time to rest, a cup of tea and reading the newspapers. And a little after 5, the last event of this trip, which was a reception and seminar of educators invited from the region, Tennessee, West Virginia, Alabama, college presidents and superintendents of high schools, and social workers in the pioneering new phases of education. It had been planned for out of doors from a lovely terrace of the mansion. Yesterday it had been in the 80s. Today it had fallen into the 50s and cold and drizzly. And it really posed a logistic problem for dear Catherine and Liz and the sound man. But finally we were set up in the main living room and the sun porch thrown together, where nearly everybody could have a folding chair with a large segment of the press standing around, and a round table discussion moderated by Doug Cater, Dr. Rose of the University of Alabama, Governor Hewlett Smith of West Virginia, and a striking, beautifully articulate Negro woman named Elizabeth Burgess, head of the Foreign Language Department of all of the schools of Nashville, I think, and a sweet-faced woman who takes a classroom on wheels to crippled and handicapped children in an Appalachian area. It was moving, thrilling, exciting, what is happening in education in this decade in this country. I gave the briefest summary of our whole trip, and then Lyndon spoke for about 50 minutes. It became one of those times when you were caught up in a spell, deeply stirred, and I hoped it was being taken down on tape and don't think it was. But I knew for sure I was married to an extraordinary man. Nevertheless, it got too long, and I was writing out a note saying close soon, and he, with eyes in the back of his head, observed it and told the audience so, lightening the mood and making them laugh, and kept right on talking. Though it was too long, that many people went away, I believe, feeling that they knew this human being, Lyndon Johnson, better, and I think with a modicum of inspiration, that rare quality. Nevertheless, the high point of the evening for me was John Gardner's short speech. He said simply that normally he's reserved, but only because he was so affected by the trip, that for the first time in his 20 months in the cabinet, he wanted to pay respect to the president in public. It has been a privilege to see the generative power of one man's deep conviction. That, for me, was the gift of the trip. The governor and Catherine and Linda and I shook hands with all the educators in the hall as they filed by into the dining room for a very late refreshment. I think we must have talked at least 45 minutes longer than anyone had expected. And then he hurried upstairs for a back sitting room meeting with Buford and about 8 or 10 editors and publishers from Nashville and the area, including our old friend Ed Ray, an attractive young man named Kennedy. It was the room where we've had so many meetings that have had import for the future. I sat in with them for a while and had a drink, very welcome at the end of this day, and divided my time between there and Catherine's bedroom, where Anne and their adorable grandchild, Melinda, and their son-in-law, Tim Wagner, and I all had a happy little visit, mostly admiring the baby and talking about Lucy and Linda, the things that she was going to do to the mansion. Thank heavens I remembered John Gardner, who was still a guest in one of the rooms. Catherine graciously sent to find him and bring him in to Buford and the men. It was a long question and answer session, a little needling, but mostly earnest searching after facts, it seemed to me. And Lyndon was in great form. It was a little past 9 when we went down to the dining room, Buford and Catherine, Lyndon and I and John Gardner and the editors, for a delicious dinner, one of many in this house for me. And after 10, we left for the airport, the weary and loving goodbye to Catherine and Buford. I went to the stateroom and collapsed, so much so that I was completely oblivious to the very rough weather, tremendous wind during the last part of our flight, and the sympathetic apology of the crew as I got off the plane was my first news that it had been bad. It was nearly 2 o'clock when we were in bed at the White House. But I couldn't have spent 3 days of my life better, no matter how wearing.